I'm very pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse, Professor Martin Drum from Notre Dame University. Welcome back, Martin.
It's great to be here, Michael.
Well, so much is happening. There's Romo debt. Everything surrounding Brittany Higgins seems to turn inflammable. Trump is always inflammable. Russia and the Ukraine are highly inflammable. Rockingham, less so. The protests, certainly. The Voice getting that way, and the Matildas, well, let's hope they're on fire for the rest of the World Cup, Martin. But let's start with Robo debt. We had Commissioner Catherine Holmes's report. She sent off a closed report, and now we learn that some 16 referrals are being considered by the Australian Public Service Commission, including at least seven public servants who got bad reviews in Commissioner Holmes's report. It looks like some sort of disciplinary day of reckoning is soon to be visited on the public sector in Canberra. Have you been following it?
I have, and I think we've broached the topic a few times. It's good to see some follow through on this. Sometimes we hear of different prosecutions and not much happens. This is a key issue of accountability. As we've discussed before, I think it's one of the worst instances of maladministration, and the amount of evidence that was piled up that the Royal Commission considered was extraordinary. We had, of course, the other development, Michael, I don't know if you followed it, for just the fifth time in this term of Parliament, former Prime Minister Scott Morrison got up. And his speech claimed in Parliament, claimed that the whole thing was an overreaction and nothing to see here, and in fact was a bit of a witch hunt. And it was a very Trumpian in approach. It was the double down approach. It's a, we didn't do anything wrong. And in fact, this is nothing more than, you know, the weaponizing of a tool of administration against us. But that flies in the face of this extraordinary amount of evidence and witnesses around the country that talked about the very real impact that policy decision had on them. So this level of accountability is really important. And it's one of those situations where everyone seemed to be blaming everyone else. The bureaucrats said that they, we advised further up the line. The politicians said that they were misadvised or misunderstood what we're saying or weren't informed properly. Everyone, it's the plausible deniability, Michael, that people then go down. And unless someone's held accountable for these very serious instances, how can we have trust in government? So I think that's really critical.
The statement issued by the Public Service Commission reflects very much the points you were making, Martin. They said, and I quote, "An assessment will now be undertaken to establish in each case whether there are sufficient grounds to commence an investigation into suspected breaches of the APS Code of Conduct." And this is what it's all about. I mean, you can't have government suborning or seeming to suborn public servants, senior or junior. Otherwise, our system of government as we want it to work won't work. Martin, perhaps we can leave Robodeck. I've mentioned the name Brittany Higgins. I know everything that seems connected with the events we associate with her is highly flammable. Senator Linda Reynolds has now sued her for defamation for some social media posts. Of course, the primary criminal proceedings are at an end, and one doubts that they will ever be resumed. There are other civil proceedings, I think, that have been commenced in relation to that. And then we had, strangely, Shane Drumgold, the silk who was prosecuting that criminal proceeding, complaining about interference, for want of a better word. Then Walter Sofronoff, retired president of the Queensland Court of Appeal, was asked to look into what happened with the prosecution. And then remarkably, as I say, everything is inflamed in this in this matter. His report to the ACT government gets leaked. or it's given under embargo to a couple of news outlets, and we still don't quite know what has happened, but it's been publicised before time. It was on the ABC News last night, it was in the Australian before that, and everyone's reporting on it, which seems an extraordinary event, but no one's doubting what's been reported is correct. This is another very peculiar exercise in public administration, Martin.
It's more of what we've seen all throughout this messy saga is the media weaponized by various sides of this discussion of various parties to these court proceedings, etc., to try and influence public opinion. And it's what it's done is it's totally derailed justice. So no one really understands either what went on, but also what happened subsequent to that, and who was responsible and how people were treated, and those key aspects, because they're clouded by a variety of different media links and opinions. And in the meantime, I think that you've got, I wouldn't want to be in either the shoes of the accused or the accuser, because they're the centre of media storms, and both of them have had their reputations severely impugned. It's not clear what the truth of the matter is. And I think we're in for more of the same. We've got another defamation suit, I think, that's being launched as well. So, you know, it's an example of how the judicial system should be allowed to get on with its work, and people should be very careful about commenting on specific cases before the final decision. Everyone knows that the broader issue around the way women are treated in politics is a really serious one, but this particular case has always been compromised, I think.
It's difficult to imagine how it's all going to finish up. I imagine with a bit of a whimper in the end, it'll disappear for practical political purposes, but it probably has got a bit of political weaponising still to go with it, Martin.
Oh, I think so. I don't think it's finished at all. I think the various people that are seen as lined up on one side or another are attacked politically. So there's no doubt that politics has been in this from the start, and both in terms of holding the government to account and critiquing government, but also in terms of media management from government. So I think you could probably say the political class has a lot to answer here.
Well, the political class are alive and well in the United States. We've tried to avoid mentioning the word Trump, but we no longer can, Martin. He appeared in the court in Washington, D.C. Yesterday. He has four major charges brought against him: conspiracy to defraud the United States, conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding, obstruction of an attempt to obstruct an official proceeding, and conspiracy against rights. They're sort of shorthand ways of describing some complex charges brought against him, but we all know that they relate to the January the 6th Capitol invasion, uprising, whatever you want to call it. And there are various media descriptions of how Mr. Trump is claiming that he's a terrible victim in this, and it's political persecution. Is it?
Well, I think that's really up for the courts to decide. And this is he certainly claimed that. But this is by far the most serious charges levelled against Trump to date. We know that he's in trouble for his relationship with a former sex worker. We know that he's in trouble. There's charges relating to his use of classified documents and his refusal to hand them over. But this is by far the most significant, and it relates directly to that January 6th coup. It's interesting reading the arraignment, reading Jack Smith's comments that said he's entitled to dispute and, you know, to point out problems in the electoral process and even dispute it. He's entitled to use all legal avenues to challenge an election result. But what his actions amounted to on January 6th was far beyond that, and a threat to democracy, effectively. This is going to be a massive trial if it gets to trial, and if it happens before the 2024 presidential elections. I expect that probably Trump will try and push it out as far as possible. So watch this space. I think it's an extraordinary development. in the 24 presidential race.
The slow smouldering other issue, which might result in a charge against him, concerns his attempt to influence how they were counting votes down in Georgia. We are yet to hear whether there will be further charges there, but it's been suggested they could be bigger than any of what we've just talked about. We'll wait and see and talk about it when and if it happens. Conflagration continues in the Ukraine-Russia dispute, war. Martin, we even see now that some drones are hitting skyscrapers in Moscow. Of course, Russia's been trying to bomb the bejesus out of anything that's got grain near it in Odessa. It doesn't mean they always hit the grain. They hit cathedrals and other residential places too. It's an unhappy development. Is it fair? Is it working? Is the so-called counteroffensive of Ukraine causing it, perhaps?
I don't know that the counteroffensive to date from Ukraine has been as successful as they would have liked. They've made small gains in a number of areas to put pressure on Russian positions, but they're yet to break through, make significant breakthroughs in Russian defences. And when you have heavily entrenched forces, we saw this with the Russians when they tried to have the Bakhmut offensive, the number of people you have to channel in to try and break through defences is extraordinary on the ground, and the resources required. Russia didn't have a lot of success, and I'm not sure Ukraine's had a lot of success. It probably speaks to the quagmire that both sides find themselves in now in eastern Ukraine. But you pointed to some really interesting and significant developments. The attack on the Odessa Cathedral, cathedral was very significant and really spoke. I mean, this was a destruction of a significant cultural monument. And it just, it's a reminder that in war, it's not just about attacking military installments. So many other things are lost during war. So that's a very, that was a very sobering development. And the other one that you mentioned is we're now seeing Ukraine attacks on Russian soil. We never saw that before for much of this war. It's all been fought on Ukraine soil. Now we're seeing Ukraine attacks in Crimea, Russian-held Crimea, and you're seeing Ukraine attacks even in Moscow via drones. So it's bringing home the war to Russia on their territory, which is another development that we hadn't seen. So the broadening of the war is another fairly recent development.
Martin, we touched on the by-election for the state seat of Rockingham last week. You suggested it wasn't anything to get too excited about. There'd be a bit of a swing against the government, as you'd expect in a by-election, and after a very popular premier had retired from office. What did you make of the result?
If you normally had a 33% swing against any political party in a by-election, you'd say that was absolutely extraordinary, which is what happened on the primary vote for Labor. If you had a 22% two-party preferred swing, you'd say that's absolutely extraordinary. But we've got to remember the context, and that's the context is that the result last time was completely and utterly bizarre and extraordinary itself. So the base was so high last time that there was still a fairly comfortable win for the Labor Party, even with that size swing against it. I would say it's neither a good result for Labor nor a complete disaster, and it's neither a good result, a really good result for the Liberals, nor a complete disaster either. Because the Liberals didn't get a really big swing towards them despite that. They only went back up to about 2017 primary levels. Last time they won an election, they got 32% of the primary in Rockingham. This time they're at just under 18%. So there's a big difference. There's still a fair way for them to climb to win the 2025 election. But I suppose they could certainly say that it's a step forward, and clearly Mark McGowan's departure will reshape how the 25 elections run and won.
Martin, something happened during this week that makes one think that the new Premier Roger Cook is singing from the same hymn sheet as the former Premier Mark McGowan, the borough protesters who are wanting to see Woodside stop damaging rock art in that area, but also taking real steps to transition to net zero so far as climate change is concerned, a group or a couple of them turned up, it seems, at the City Beach home, as we now know it to be, of the CEO. And it turns out also that a Four Corners camera and reporting group were there following the events. The Premier came out in fairly strong terms, supportive of Woodside and decrying these protests. And there have been charges of conspiracy and other things. The police seem to be really upping the ante when it comes to these particular quite active protest steps. Do we have a new day in the protest movement? Is there an obvious attempt to try and snuff it right out? Where do you think this might finish up?
This has been an interesting one. I would say all the media coverage and the reaction by government and other places, etc., has probably given what was a really small protest by a couple of people a lot more air in media than they otherwise would have got. So there's that. Look, the issue from government, and it's been raised in competitive media outlets, you know, and let's not forget that media is a competition business. And so critique of other media outlets is part and parcel of that. But it's around these people protesting at the private residence of a Woodside executive. So that seems to be the flashpoint here. And whether they trespassed on that residence and in effect invaded the personal privacy space of the CEO. And I think she said that she was quite upset by that. But it does really get us thinking about where are those limits of civil disobedience? What are the rules? And I think that you and I talked about this with COVID protests as well. Like, protest itself is an anti-establishment thing. So expecting protesters to always follow the rules, it doesn't really work like that. You know, by their nature, whether social norms, whether we have social norms that we expect, they're not often not going to abide by them. So they will be taken through the judicial system themselves. Be interesting to see whether that continues or whether that the particular protest group changes tact, etc. But the name of a lot of protests are always trying to do something new and different and push the envelope.
Well, I think it might be time for Fremantle Shipping News to sponsor a public seminar in Fremantle about protests. Fremantle, in many ways, has been the birthplace of all sorts of protests. So something for us to think about. But in the meantime, we've got plenty to think about with the yes and no campaigns on The Voice. This weekend, I think, Martin Lee Garma Festival is on. Mr. Dutton's not turning up. The Prime Minister is. It was always said that once the Garma Festival was held, or perhaps at it, the date for the Voice referendum would be announced. What are you expecting?
I'm not sure. He's also said that he believes that the Voice referendum should be treated like a normal political campaign, given, you know, the routine 5 weeks formal notice, etc. I don't think that will quite wash. I think that he'll have to give more notice than that. I'm not sure that he's necessarily ready to charge on in and announce the date just yet. I could be wrong. I think that there's probably some work being done in government and around government on the strategy for the Voice referendum. We had, again, a whole week of discussion about treaty and where that intersects with the Voice this week. Of course, there's no secret that the Uluru Statement calls for a treaty and calls for healing, truth and healing process alongside a Voice. So it's not a big dirty secret or anything. It's actually been out there all along. And it's been suggested that there's a clear process all along. But what we saw in political debate is the sort of suggestion that the government had a secret agenda for the treaty. I'd say it's not really a secret agenda. I think that they've said all along that they intend to do a treaty at some stage, but that's a long and complex process down the track. And of course, I think this will come through, particularly in the no vote. No vote sees some value in conflating the voice and the treaty. Yes, they're connected, but they are substantially different initiatives.
Point's been made, and it's obviously the case that not only do we have treaty processes underway in a number of jurisdictions in Australia, notably Victoria, I think South Australia and the Northern Territory, but it's also a complex process. You would expect this to go on probably for a good decade before you could conclude something. But it's always been part of the statement from the heart from Uluru, as you say. By the way, I was asked yesterday when interviewed for a podcast with the Fremantle Chamber of Commerce what my views on the voice were, and they can be found by going and looking at the video podcast, Martin, to be found later today on Fremantle Shipping News, but also on Facebook on the Fremantle Chamber of Commerce page. I talk about a lot of other things beside. An unusual experience to be asked questions, Martin.
Normally judges are doing adjudication, aren't they?
Well, exactly. No correspondence will be entered into. But there will be questions still, I think, asked of the Matildas coach if they don't win against Denmark and Yellen and win the cup. What do you think?
No, I think they can win. I do think they can win. If you look about where the Matildas are placed, notwithstanding the noise about expectations that a home country has when they host the World Cup, they're ranked about ninth in the world. So what's that tell you? It tells you that under normal circumstances, they should probably be winning their round of 16th. So I think that and Denmark has not really been in great form. They've got through, but they haven't been in great form. And expect Matildas could win this one, should win this one. After that, I think it does get much trickier once you get down to the final eight, I think. And you're talking very good sides. High caliber opposition, the best in the world. So I'd anticipate that they should still be winning at round 16. And for the Matildas coach, if they think they get in the final eight, then that's probably a pass mark. Obviously, they'll be aiming much higher than that. But that's probably the threshold going in, that secretly behind the scenes that they regard as their minimum benchmark.
Martin, I still don't think we're going to see the great Sam Kerr play anytime soon. What about you?
If she's not 100% ready, you definitely keep her on the bench, because if you think you can win this one without her, you definitely keep her on the bench. And you've got to be very careful with muscle injuries and calf injuries. I don't know about you, Michael. I've had a few in my time, and you can walk on them, you can run on them, you can turn on them, but if you try and take off suddenly, you try and turn really sharply, if you want to jump in the air, yeah, who knows? Treat with caution.
Well, our listeners will probably be saying, what on earth has Matilda's got to do with this political? Well, it's very clear. I'm sure there's a plot afoot that if the Matildas can win the cup, the voice referendum will be held very soon afterwards. But on that note, Martin, it was lovely to talk with you again, and have a great week.
It's a pleasure, Michael.